everyone. I'm Gary Nall. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, we're going to take a look at a very important topic, and that is, the clock is ticking, and why is so little being done about it? Lots of rhetoric, some of it very impressive, lots of euphemisms. They talk about the commitment and Mother Earth, but what are we actually doing? Collectively, individually, by state, county, city, federal government, world, countries? That's the issue, and that's where the rub comes in. Today, we will begin our program with Dr. Guy McPherson. Guy is a professor emeritus of natural resources, ecology, and environmental evolutionary biology at the University of Arizona. He has specialized in forest resources, energy decline, and climate change, and its economic consequences. In the past, he's also been on the faculty of Texas A&M University, as well as the University of California at Berkeley. He is also a person who is honest in his disillusionment with the American University environment and academia, especially after attempts by university officials to tell him to calm down. Don't make it so negative. Don't be fatalistic. In effect, don't tell the truth. And for the past 30 years, there have only been a handful of individuals who I believe have had the courage to tell the truth as they know it, and it was not in alignment with the official consensus. The official consensus is, yes, the globe is warming. Yes, there are some unusual events, but we have at least 80 to 100 years to deal with it. And then we will deal with it piece by piece. So when you hear the people coming back, all very happy about the environmental consensus they've reached at various conferences around the world, Paris or any of the others, then you ask, well, how much of that consensus is based upon voluntary change? How much was mandatory change? And then you start realizing it's all voluntary. There is no mandatory. There is no effort in the United States, for example, and we're one of the two largest polluters. The first by a long margin is China. We're second, India's third. Together, we represent 53% of all global warming gases that are being emitted into the environment, at least those that are by humans and agriculture. Agriculture alone represents anywhere from a low of 18 to a high of 26%. Now, mind you, that's very important because what you select to eat and the true cost of it, as far as a carbon footprint and or a methane footprint, is never discussed. So if you think that there's no cost to the environment by heating a hamburger or having a pork chop or a piece of chicken, you would be mistaken. There's a huge economic cost to that. In fact, right now there's a movement to see how many people are consuming chickens, and there's never been more chicken consumed in our history. Watch advertising on television, and you'll see why. So what Dr. McPherson is going to do today in the first part of our program is give us an honest, professional assessment. And remember, he's not talking in isolation. He's not in an echo chamber. He is one of about 30, more or less, people involved in climate science, and they're distinguished in their backgrounds. They are all published in peer-reviewed literature. Almost all have held important academic or foundational positions. So they're not just the average lay person. They're not conspiracy theorists. They're not just frothing at us. They're trying to show us that the clock is almost at midnight, and we're acting like we've got all the time in the world, possibly not even in the lifetime of someone being born today. They won't have to do anything serious. That is a grave error. Now, later in the program, from the other side of the world, will be Kevin Hester. Kevin is the host of a radio program called Nature Bats Last with climate change scholar Guy McPherson. Guy started the show and then went on a sabbatical. Now he's back in the United States, and we're happy to have him back. And his voice is very important, and he is one of the most popular hosts of all of our outstanding hosts on the Progressive Radio Network. His program airs every Tuesday at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Kevin lives off the small, off-the-grid island in near the city of Auckland in New Zealand. And he's completed 16 ocean passages on small yachts, over half of them as skipper. Or he goes all over the world. And so he is here also to share his perspective. But we're going to start with Guy. Guy, nice to have you with us.
Thank you, Gary. It's a pleasure always.
First, let us be realistic about what we're talking about. Most people think there's a problem. It's only global warming. That's only one of many problems. Before we get to global warming and how long we have and why don't we take the people on a journey who may not be familiar with the state of the world? And if you could take them around the world and show them some really serious things happening that are getting worse, not better, and how that's impacting the people there, even though it may not be impacting a person listening where they're at. And then from that overview, then show us what, if you were to say, pay careful attention, class, here's what's going to come through the door now, not in 100 years, right now, depending upon where you live, and then make it more personal by showing people how intimate this association is with the people who may not have paid attention, have lost their lives or homes, and they're rebuilding, and the insurance isn't going to cover them, the government's not going to protect them, and they're going to lose it again. They're just not getting that message. And I'd like to ask you why people are not moving out of harm's way, even when the area they're living in has been devastated, like California or Mississippi, Alabama, most of Texas, especially down around Houston and Brownsville, and then Louisiana and Florida. The forum is yours.
Thank you. That's a wonderful introduction. And in many places around the world, people are moving. I was on a speaking tour in Western Europe nearly 4 years ago, and the common complaint was that there were a bunch of folks coming up from the Middle East and Northern Africa looking for a place to land. And there was tremendous pushback from the Western Europeans about that. I mean, we're talking about people coming from as far away as the Fertile Crescent, where civilization got its roots, had its roots. And so in some places, people know about massive refugee crises. Look just south of the United States border as another example of a refugee crisis coming from Central America, primarily Honduras, and people fleeing those areas because they no longer are able to grow food. In the case of the Middle East and Northern Africa, we're talking about people who had lived there literally for generations. They were part of a family that might be 15 or 20 generations in the same location, and now they find themselves unable to grow food sufficient to support themselves. We're seeing the same sort of thing happen in Central America and people fleeing, trying to get to the United States where there might be safe harbor. Within the United States, we don't have to look far. Miami is plagued by a largely unknown water crisis. But the city of Miami is having its water supply encroached upon by brackish seawater beneath the surface. That brackish seawater is encroaching into the freshwater lens that serves the Miami metropolitan area and making it increasingly difficult to clean up the water sufficient to United States safety standards so that it can be delivered through the taps. Let's go to the other coast. Let's go to California. I think most people who haven't been living under a rock for the last several months are aware that California is literally on fire, that the fire season this last year, just wrapping up now, has been truly astonishing in its scope. The number and size of fires, the number of structures burned, the number of homes lost, and the number of people died set all kinds of records in California. So it's not just an isolated place here and there. It's headlines popping up that include things like the southwestern United States is in the midst of a dust bowl. And that's running all the way, as you mentioned, from Texas to New Mexico, Arizona, up to Oklahoma, and even further north. So the kinds of climatic and weather-related events that have been predicted for literally a generation in this country by a young Al Gore and a young Carl Sagan on the floor of the United States Senate in 1985, by James Hansen in 1988, also on the floor of Congress. These are the kinds of warnings that we've been hearing about since the 1980s, and even earlier, if you get away from Congress and get into the newspapers, and nothing was done. And so here we are. We're at the point where we are looking at a scorched earth. You know, if you pursue a scorched earth policy long enough, you end up with a scorched earth. And I'm afraid, I'm sad to have to say, that that's where we are. We have places that are too wet for people to live, too dry for people to live, on fire, unable to grow food. Look for every potential symptom of abrupt climate change, and you'll find it. It's there. It's all there, and it's truly catastrophic.
Okay. Now I'd like to go to a yes or no. Do you believe that life for most people on the planet, including in the United States, will be adversely affected by climate events in the next 3 years?
Yes.
Do you believe
that
there's
no doubt in my mind.
All right. Do you believe that the estimation we were given recently by the ultra-conservative group of nearly 2,000 environmental scientists of 12 years is realistic, or do you believe that we have less time to make dramatic changes, have a Marshall Plan to use all the worldwide resources we have to correct these imbalances? Do you believe it's less than 12 years?
It's absolutely less than 12 years. And in fact, the United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres said on September 10th of this year, so just about 2 months ago, we have until 2020 to change course in order to avoid the worst effects of climate change. So at the same time, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change was saying we have until 2030 to change course, the Secretary General of the United Nations was saying we have a month and a half at that time, and now it's a year and a couple of weeks away. We do not have until 2030.
Okay. Please give us an idea of the scenario likely to occur so that we make it more realistic and factual so people can actually get a coming attraction of, if he is correct, what is the likely outcome?
There was a paper in the 2012 edition of the Annual Review of Earth and Planetary Sciences indicating that, and this is written by four authors, three of the authors were at the time, and I believe still are, paid by the U.S. Naval Postgraduate College, and they projected an ice-free Arctic Ocean or nearly ice-free Arctic Ocean in 2016 plus or minus 3 years. We have dodged six bullets, 2013, 2014, 2015, 2016, 2017, and 2018. Will we dodge another one next year? The president of Finland has been going around the world for more than a year pointing out that if we lose the ice in the Arctic Ocean, then it won't be long before we lose habitat for human beings on planet Earth. I don't think that we have long with ice still covering the Arctic Ocean. And when that's gone, when that ice disappears, or even when it gets down to a million square kilometers, which is a scientific definition of an ice-free Arctic, I think that we're going to see the methane spew out even faster than it is. We're going to see the collapse of albedo. We're going to have a blue ocean soaking up heat instead of white ice reflecting back the heat. The number of feedbacks associated with, or self-reinforcing feedback loops associated with, an ice-free or nearly ice-free Arctic is certain to accelerate. I think that we'll be lucky to get through next year, 2019, with an ice-free Arctic. And even if we do, will we make it another year or another 2 years? It would really very much surprise me, given the thin and slushy ice in the Arctic right now. And what happens in the Arctic does not stay in the Arctic. This is a worldwide phenomenon. This is the planetary air conditioner we're talking about. Without ice in the Arctic Ocean, I just don't see how life is going to remain anything like it is right now in the Northern Hemisphere, and within months or a year in the Southern Hemisphere as well. I just don't see the system we called civilization holding together for much longer in the absence of ice in the Arctic. And obviously the lack of global dimming associated with the demise of industrial civilization, or even a meaningful, substantial decline in industrial activity, will be sufficient to push the planet well beyond the point at which humans have inhabited it before. We're currently at the highest global average temperature experienced by Homo sapiens in our 300-year existence. How far are we willing to push this thing?
All right. Give us a very specific example of what will happen. The average person listening, it still sounds, I'm sure, a little existential. Well, I have food. I have air conditioning. It's not that bad. And they could say that living in 100, 500, or 1,000 towns and cities in the United States. But what they're not counting upon is that virtually everything in their community every day is dependent upon what happens in other places of the world. So explain what is likely to happen when it's ice-free. What then will occur that would cause society in different regions to begin to collapse?
Well, shortly thereafter, timing is everything here, as is often the case. So if the ice-free Arctic occurs early enough in the year, say July, and I don't think anybody knows the exact number here because this has never happened in human history. So there's some guesswork going on here. But if we have an ice-free Arctic as early as July, then I think it will warm significantly in the places where grains are grown. Almost exclusively, that's in the interior of large continents in the Northern Hemisphere. That's places like Europe and Asia and North America in the interior. Bear in mind that the interior of these large continents heats up at least twice as fast as the global average. So when we get to the point that we have warmed the globe as a result of an ice-free Arctic in July or August, that might actually cause the corn crop to fail that same year. If the ice-free Arctic occurs in, say, September, close to the autumnal equinox in the Northern Hemisphere, then probably it wouldn't be until the following year that the grain crops failed, and starting with the winter/spring wheat crops in the interior of large continents in the Northern Hemisphere. What that means is no bread on the shelves. Now, every civilization depends upon bread and circuses. I've no doubt we'll have circuses right till the end. But without bread on the shelves, without food on the shelves, at a very large scale, remember, we're adding more than 200,000 people to the planet every single day, births minus deaths. So if we have a supply disruption of something as important as bread, that is going to spread catastrophically quickly to other sectors as well. So a supply disruption in wheat or corn or any form of grain almost certainly leads to a rapid attempt, an emergency situation, to get food from wherever it can be found. What happens? The system is stretched so tight already on every front, whether it's delivery of fuel to the filling stations, various kinds of food to the grocery stores, all of which are persisting on a 3 or 4 day supply for the customer base they serve, whether it's water infrastructure that allows the water to keep coming through the taps, all of those, it's such a very fragile web. And then you extend that to the financial markets, which obviously are really shaky. The Bank of International Settlements just came out with a warning earlier today indicating that the system is in far worse shape than it was in 2008 and is shaky enough based on the derivatives market that all hell could break loose at pretty much any time. All these things are related. And if we have a reduction in industrial activity because of any of those factors, of as little as 35%, that can cause up to a 1 degree Celsius global average temperature rise in a matter of weeks. We are absolutely not prepared for that eventuality. That would eliminate a huge proportion of life on Earth because of the rapidity of change. So, you know, I try not to overstate the case. But I think in this situation, it would be almost impossible for me to overstate the case. I think it's so dire that we're so close to the edge here that and denial and the bargaining that I see going on is profound. And I just don't see how we got out of this mess, especially given that we're still talking about 2030 and the things that have to be done and nothing's being done. So that's my biggest concern right there.
I simply have one follow-up before we go to Kevin Hester in New Zealand, and that is, in the United States, we have a minimum of 58 million people living on the coast. That's from New Hampshire, Maine, clear down to Key West, around the Gulf, up the coast of Florida, hitting all the major cities, and then around on the other side, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana and Texas, and then around the other side, up through California, Washington, and Oregon. Those people are not going to move. Many of those people have invested their life savings in a home with beautiful views. They want water. And so they're not moving. Then we have more people than ever moving into Phoenix. And yet this year, Phoenix doesn't have any water of its own. It's getting the water from the Little Colorado, and that supplies 40 million Americans in the Southwest with their water. All of Nevada's water comes from there. And Lake Mead is drying up. It's held back by the Hoover Dam. So now you've got people moving to places that are not sustainable by any measure. Also, the sandstorm, not a dust storm. Those were common in the 1930s. But I'm talking about a sandstorm, the type of storm you would see in Saudi Arabia, or in Kuwait, or any of the United Arab countries, that's now happening in the United States. Though the largest sandstorm in the United States occurred this year, two of them in Phoenix. And it looked like out of a science fiction film, where suddenly you see Phoenix, and in the background, as far as you could see, up and down, in both directions, sand. And sand is not dust. Sand is extremely destructive to foliage, to fruit trees. It'll strip all the fruit off of tree. To people, it scrapes up their car and their house. And if you're out in one of those sandstorms, you can have the skin ripped off of you. And that was once in a 500-year storm. And we had two in 1 year, and we had one last year. So they've had three storms, sandstorms, in under 18 months. And no one's talking about that. Then you also have more people living in Nevada, in Las Vegas, and that's not sustainable. New Mexico, they're running out of water. That's not sustainable. Colorado's running out of water. Kansas is running out of water. And Oklahoma, as you mentioned, and 80% of Texas. So when you're taking an honest look, the issue is, where are these people going to go when they suddenly realize they have no choice but to be a person who is taking whatever belongings they have left and moving. These are migrants, environmental migrants, and refugees in our own country. And there's not a single state, local, federal government initiative to plan for this, to try to make it orderly, to try to get people to go to places where there could be some quality of life. Your thoughts?
I couldn't agree more, Gary. It seems that there's no plan. There is, as nearly as I can tell, nobody has any idea what to do. It's as if we listened to the climate scientists for too long, who said we have until 2100. So everybody thought, oh, we can wait until 2090 to plan. And we're caught with our pants down. There's no contingency for dealing with loss of habitat at various places in the country, much less around the globe. What are we going to do with the people who can't get food? What are we going to do with the people who can't get water? And it seems to me we've waited far, far too long to deal with the situation in any meaningful way. I think that as a consequence, at this point, there's nothing to be done. We're going to face a dire emergency, even worse than the situation we're in now, and nobody is going to have a clue. We're just going to wait around for somebody else, whoever that somebody is, the gods, the aliens, the government, whoever you expect to come in and save you at the 11th hour. But they're not going to come in and save you at the 11th hour. So I see nothing but heartache in the near future.
You're going to have anarchy. By the way, just so I don't know if you're aware of it, but at the Davos, the richest, like 3,000 to 5,000 people meet once a year in Davos, Switzerland. And interesting, they're all interested now in survival. And I even have counseled people who've gone there who say, where are the best places to go when the crisis occurs? There's a big awareness on the part of people who have money of how they want to be safe and supply themselves now for the future. They're hunkering down. They want to be not where someone could rob them and steal from them. And so if you live near a major city or a suburb and you have food that is in short supply, the people who have the money will always have food, the ones who don't. Now you're in a dystopian environment, and we've never considered the possibility that such an advanced technological society could be so inept at the human consciousness level. And yet, we're going to see this happen. We see it in other countries. We see Yemen. We see starvation. We see a mother having to choose which of her two children she gives the little meager amount of food that she has that day to, knowing the other one may die because of it. We've never anticipated that could happen here, but it's absolutely, positively, irreversible that it's going to happen right here. And that concerns me. So I want you to hold your thoughts, please. If you've just tuned in, I'm Gary Knoll. We're doing a special climate change and the future of humanity discussion. We're at the 12th hour, and yet very few people are paying attention. We're going to go now to New Zealand. We've just been hearing Guy McPherson. Kevin Hester, who I introduced earlier in the program, is on. Nice to have you with us today, Kevin.
Kia ora, Gary. It's wonderful to be back on your show.
Kevin, I'm going to ask you a different question that I asked Guy. And it deals with this kind of utopian, New Agey, faux spiritual element that comes together and says, we have the intelligence, we have the science, we have the technology, we will save the world, and we have it, we can do it. Okay, I hope so. I would certainly support it. But then I take an honest look and I look at the three major polluters that represent 53% of total emissions, China number one, United States number two, and India number three. You're also looking at a planet with 7.7 billion people. You're looking at 2 billion almost 800 million people. You're looking at almost a third, more than a third, of the entire population. Here is the problem as I see it. And then please deconstruct my argument. Show me where I'm in error. I'm happy to correct it. This is one time I want to be wrong. China just announced that it is building the largest city in history. They're bringing three different mega complexes together by high-speed rail, and in the middle of this gigantic complex the size of the Netherlands, that's how big it is, the first city is almost complete, and it will hold 140 million to 160 million citizens. Already, around 850 million of its citizens now live in cities. They still have a lot to go, but they also have very little agriculture. The average size of a parcel of land in China that is farmed is a hectare, about 2.5 acres. That makes it one of the smallest farming-sized elements in the world. If you look at the size of a farm in the United States, it's much larger than that. So they, in order to make these cities thrive, they're going to be industrial hubs. For example, already done, it's there, is the world's largest mall. How large is it? 5 miles. 5 contiguous miles. How many vendors have little booths there? 75,000 vendors in one mall. It's just one part of this. And they have put all their technology and trillions of dollars into this investment. This is part of their Silk Road complex. So now they're going to be building mega complexes around 68 other countries that have joined them in the both the water route and in the land route to suit Eurasia. And remember, if you take in all of Eurasia and Southeast countries, the Philippines, Malaysia, and India, and Myanmar, you're dealing, and the Koreas, you're dealing with a population that dwarfs the United States and dwarfs the European Union, which right now is the largest spending bloc for 545 million people. So the amount of energy necessary to build these infrastructures, to supply these people, including with food, and the number one food that the new Chinese and the new Indians want is meat. In the last year alone, China increased its meat to its population by 300%. So now to get that meat, it's having to go around, because it doesn't have its own, it has a large landmass, but it's almost all desert. It goes to Brazil. It makes a deal down there with the new fascist leader, and they take their genetically engineered soybeans, they cut down the lungs of the planet, where carbon sinks exist by phenomenal amounts and gives off oxygen, and they cut down those trees, and they plant soybeans and ship them back to China to be fed to their pork and beef. They then rent out other places or buy places, and they're also in all over Africa. Any place that has fertile land in Africa, they're renting it or buying it. And in the process, if they're giving money, billions of dollars per country. Now, you know that many of these countries are corrupt. Most countries of the world are corrupt. In fact, almost all the countries of the world are corrupt at some level, especially where the policymakers and opinion leaders dwell. They get the money, and China has made it clear, if you don't pay it back, then we privatize industries. They're already privatizing industries in different countries that didn't give them back the money. Now, all this while they were getting the yuan as a mixed currency, starting very low, now it's inching up, backed by gold. So they're exploiting minerals all over the world. They're exploiting labor all over the world. They're putting money in people's pockets around half the world. And now Russia has joined with them. India has joined with them. The BRICS nations are all together on this, including Brazil, South Africa. So on the one hand, they're creating more solar panels than anyone else. They create 80% of them. But on the other hand, they have no human rights. They have they're monitoring their citizens. They have 1 million Islamic followers, Muslims, in detention camps, which are concentration camps. They're harvesting the organs of the Uyghurs, almost 100 million of them in hospitals. That's why it takes you a year to 2 years to get a heart here in the United States. You can get three hearts in the same day in China because they have these people in hospitals. This is not a secret, by the way. Anyone with a brain and ability to research will find this out. So how is it that the United States is based upon growing our economy and India is growing its economy, Brazil's trying to grow its economy and sell its resources in the process, and China's got the roaring economy, all of which are going to exceed just those four nations, Brazil, India, United States, and China, will exceed the 2-degree increase that we've been told you cannot cross that. If you cross it, civilization will suffer tremendously. And then those four are going to do it themselves within the next 5 years, and they'll have the largest city in the world. At the same time, they'll have millions of people dying because of heat and pollution. Your thoughts?
The Chinese Belt Road Initiative simply blows out of the water anything else that's ever been attempted in human history. It is currently planned. It will involve some 7,000 separate infrastructure or extractive industry projects scattered across 70-odd nations with a total price tag of $8 trillion US dollars. It'll span half the planet from Asia to Africa, Europe, and to the South Pacific. It will affect every facet of human endeavor in one way or another. Every single analog that we monitor as the great unraveling gains momentum, as every single one of them are going in the wrong direction. Anyone talking about changing light bulbs, getting solar panels, cutting down on their personal consumption is going to have nothing whatsoever, no measurable effect whatsoever on what is happening when you see these big industrialized nations carrying on with business as usual. The late, great Edward Abbey, he had an expression that infinite growth is the ideology of the cancer cell. And we are still confronted with a capitalist system based on the infinite growth paradigm. There is no way to turn the ship around. We've already gone off the cliff. We're having this conversation now like Thelma and Louise were in their convertible after they drove off the cliff.
And what do you see, Guy? You've been listening to Guy. Guy said that according to the best reports we have, we could start seeing an Arctic free of ice as early as this coming summer or in the fall. And if that's the case, you'll start to see a shift in the capacity of certain grains to grow in the Northern Hemisphere. We're talking about North Dakota, South Dakota, Montana, Utah, Idaho, and even Colorado. Those were the higher elevations and where a lot of fruit orchards are, a lot of grains are. And if those become affected and we export a lot of that to other countries who can't grow their own foods in the Middle East and in Africa, we're going to be watching a lot of people starve. We're not going to be able to ship those out. We're not going to have enough. We're going to have shortages here. But because we can buy food from all over the world, we will be one of the last nations, I believe, to really see how bad it is until, you know, the water starts coming up the side of the Titanic and we just made ourselves comfortable on a couch. I believe that we are living in denial, but I want you to address that if you would, please.
Yeah, I'd really like to go over the aspect that where Guy mentioned a little while ago about how tenuous the global economy is. And Guy and I are extremely concerned about the implications of a major collapse of the financial institutions and the collapse of industrial civilization. I wrote an essay a few days ago on my website, kevinester.live, and I called the essay, "All Species Go Extinct, All Civilizations Collapse, All Bubbles Burst, There Is No Planet B." One of the problems we have with the global economy is that it has been funded since the 2008 global financial crisis with debt. So we had a financial crisis that was funded by or was created by debt, and since then they've piled on the debt. In 2017, the global debt was $237 trillion, and in the last year, it's gone up by another $10 trillion. Guy and my concern about when this bubble collapse is that we will lose the effect of global dimming, or what the referee journal literature refers to as the aerosol masking effect. When that happens, and it's not a matter of if or when, it is definitely going to happen. The global collapse is set in stone. You can't run a Ponzi scheme forever. They always implode. And we're going to have some kind of financial and industrial reset on the planet. When the buildings fell down in New York in 9/11, and the airplanes were grounded in America for a week. In 1 week, we had a major spike in regional temperatures in the US from the loss of global dimming. When that happens on a global level, we're going to have an extraordinary loss of increase of warming. The referee journal literature says between 1.2 and 1.5°C, and that will happen in a matter of weeks or a month or two. That is effectively a doubling of all of the warming that we've had in the last 300 years since industrial civilization. That will all happen in 6 or 8 weeks. This life that we are living now, this civilization and this ecosystem is completely and utterly on the brink of collapse. And you wouldn't believe it, but the collapse of the economic system could now mean the extinction of most, if not all, complex life on the planet. That is how tenuous our situation has become.
Heaven, I asked a guy this, I'll ask you the same question. On this life clock, the life of Earth, and our presence on it with quality of life, how long do you see we have before the quality of our life is affected forever?
Okay, well, what I would say is for 90% of the world's population, they already have a spectacularly low quality of life. Most of those people are undernourished, don't have clean water to drink, and aren't living the middle-class lifestyles that a lot of the people like you, me, Guy, and the people we know in our circle and in the cultures that we know, that is an extremely small minority on the planet. But I will be spectacularly surprised if the civilization or existence on this planet looks remotely like what we are living in 3 or 4 or 5 years. I will be surprised if we're all still alive in 5 years. And I know that for a lot of people that will sound alarmist. But, you know, remember, Winston Churchill was called an alarmist in 1937 when he was talking about the re-rise of fascism, which, you know, we're all seeing around the planet now. But he was talking about it in 1937. 8 brutal years later, 60 million people and billions of animals were dead. I think we will see that same domino effect where the dominoes will topple and it will accelerate. And I will be very, very surprised if we are still around in a few or at the most 5 years' time. I don't expect there to be a complex life on the planet in 5 years.
Give us an idea, a very specific idea, so we can see what you're suggesting as to how this is going to play out in a linear fashion.
I think that quite possibly what will happen is we'll have an economic collapse and people will wake up in the morning and their EFTPOS cards and their credit cards won't work because there'll be an international banking collapse. So straight away that means that you're not going to have trucks coming into the cities delivering all the food, the water, the medicines, all of the things that we need. You'll see first responders start staying home and not turning up for work. So you won't see the doctors and the nurses turning up at the hospitals. You won't see the firemen at the fire stations. And you won't see the factory workers turning up. And an important aspect of that is the nuclear power plant workers. You can be sure every nuclear power plant worker on the world has an exit strategy for when the shit hits the fan at work. And they won't be going to work and martyring to themselves like all the helicopter pilots did at Chernobyl when they saved the world by sacrificing their life and building that sarcophagus at Chernobyl. A lot of those people will scarper. So we will see 450 nuclear power station meltdowns in a matter of weeks. But dystopianly, much worse than the nuclear power station meltdowns will be the spent fuel pool fires. Every one of those 450 nuclear plants has three or four spent fuel pools. They have hundreds of tons of highly radioactive uranium pellets in zirconium tubes. When those workers stop going to work, those swimming pools that will overheat because there won't be chilled water pumped into them, the uranium will go critical, the heat will build up, the zirconium tubes will burn, and it will aerosol all of those radionuclides into the atmosphere. That's the kind of future we're looking at. So I really, if I could say to one thing or one thing for people to take from this, really take it that time is much shorter than you think. Live in the moment. Look after those that you love and make the most of every day because time is running out. And there is no 10 years. There is no 2 years to turn this around. There is no turning around the Titanic as it's sinking below the waves. People have to just get out of that mindset about how we're going to turn it around. We're not turning it around. We're sinking. Get as many breaths as you can. Love the ones you can as much as you can. Time is very, very short.
I'm more of an optimist in this respect. I've tried to understand the human nature equation. In this regard, almost everything that you have said, and before you, Guy said, is predicated upon the policymakers and the opinion leaders, the people who actually rule us at different levels, from medical doctors telling us what we should do for a procedure to our politicians at the state and federal level who are substantially compromised because of economic incentives they receive to vote the way special interests want. To those people heading those special interest groups, the women, for example, there's a whole group of women who run several industries like the Walton family. Those are mainly four women. Together, they have over $20 billion in assets, and yet they haven't spread that money down to other women who have made them that money to give a better standard of living. So when I take an honest look at what we have done in the last 50 years as a society, I see that we have the largest professional class in our history. We have about 71 million professionals, meaning lawyers, doctors, engineers, scientists, of which there are millions, professional people, educators who have higher advanced education. So these are highly educated people who are fully aware of cause and effect. They're not functional illiterate on any level. And yet they're careerist, and hence giving themselves quality of time, quality of life, that's always secondary. Now, they'll talk about it, but they have to make more money and have more security, which never seems to be enough. They're then impacting their children who are watching them as role models, and they have this high level of entitlement, and somehow they are better based upon their positions, who acknowledges them, who defers to them, and what they can buy that others can't. So if you gave all these very successful people a $100,000 Rolex watch, someone's going to say, but I want $120,000. I want to be able to have the bragging rights. So we're a nation of narcissists looking for the next opportunity to let someone see how successful we are. Now, those are the policymakers. It's from these people that you have your major stories written and you have your direction. They're not directing any energy towards saving the planet. None. They're not into veganism. They're not into natural living. They're not into organic. Even though some may shop at Whole Foods, that's more trendy than anything else. To show they're kind of hip, they'll take a yoga class, they'll spin on a bike, and then they'll turn around and make a deal that might cost people in another country to live with slave labor. For example, the fabrics most people wear, over 900 million garments a year are made in Bangladesh, where women make 14 cents an hour. So even the big designers will do their work there. They make more profit, their shareholders make more profit, and people have a dress that they pay less for without looking at what are the human costs in that. So if a person's allowing their children to become obese, a children to have adult diabetes, to have children vaccinated without any question and end up autistic, to have a banking system that is bailed out and they're not and don't protest, 7 million homes foreclosed on, with at least 21 million homeless Americans, not a single effort made to save their homes or cause the system to change, the return of debtors' prisons, and in a big way, and the bulging deficits that we have, and the debt that we're carrying cumulatively is $200 trillion, not including derivatives. So who exactly is going to say, now's the time that we must all work together and we must set aside our own self-interest? I don't see that happening, Kevin and Guy. I don't see there being that day where wise men and women come together, and those who do come together, the Vandana Shivas, the people like yourselves, the Ralph Naders, Chris Hedges, they're not listened to in any case because you're an existential and real threat, because the conversation you have with someone holds a very glaring mirror without any filters, and it's going to show someone who they really are. So that said, I believe that there will be a small but very strong proactive group. They exist now, probably in the neighborhood of 2 million, where a lot of millennials are moving back, want to go, not living, going back, but actually moving to an off-the-grid existence. I see people making plans now, learning how to be self-sufficient, doing hydroponics, moving where there is sustainable life and away from these crisis areas, including away from nuclear power plants. And it's not that nobody will be affected like this. It's that those people at least have a heads up. And if I have an opportunity to have a heads up, I'm seeing the tide go out. For 4 miles, I know a tsunami, 70-foot high, is coming in return. I'm going to get to high ground. So there will be people who get to high ground. There will be people who will not have the initial surge hit them economically. They're already out of a lot of the debt that otherwise people are in. And they're being realistic. They're downsizing. They're moving into eco-villages and intentional communities. So on that level, I'm optimistic. For everyone else, they're not going to make it into the lifeboat. Your final thoughts, Kevin, and then Guy, please, your final thoughts.
A lot of those people that you were talking about are bugging out to New Zealand. There's been a number of articles in the local media over the last few months with a shipment of bug-out bunkers that arrived in New Zealand and were shipped down to the South Island and were being installed. There's a Russian oligarch who's bought it at Helena Bay in the north, and he spent officially $25 million. I've heard that it's a lot more. Those people are bugging out, and they're abandoning the people who don't have the ability to do that sort of stuff. No one will get out of this alive, but you can be sure when you see the rich and ugly heading for the hills, you know the shit has either hit the fan or just about to. Thank you very much for your time, and thank you very much for this wonderful project that you've created at PRN. You're an inspiration, Gary. Thank you.
Thank you. Kevin Hester from New Zealand. Guy McPherson, final thoughts, please.
Thank you, Gary, and thanks to Kevin. Kevin, people refer to Kevin and I as alarmists, and I want to assure you that this is not the case. Consider, for example, a paper published in Scientific Reports on the 13th of November of this year titled Co-Extinctions Annihilate Planetary Life During Extreme Environmental Change. The paper points out that as little as a 5 or 6 degree Celsius global average increase in temperature could be enough to wipe out all life on Earth through a domino effect all life on Earth. That could easily happen within the next 5 to 7 years. That sounds astonishing. It sounds unbelievable. It sounds impossible. And based on the very conservative referee journal literature, it isn't. So I would encourage, as Kevin has done, I would encourage people to live with urgency, to complete relationships, to live as if the day is here. Because soon the day will be here when there are no more days for any of us. And along with Kevin, Gary, I want to thank you very much for creating the Progressive Radio Network and all the information that comes out of it. It's a wonderful project.
I appreciate those kind thoughts. I'm still going to be the optimist and say, yes, everything you're suggesting based upon your science and research and being honest, I believe that, you know, you kind of remind me, Guy, of the Scottish man in the movie The Day After Tomorrow, where he sees these, you know, weather anomalies, and then it gets so bad, and then it was, he said, it's too late for us to leave. You know, we could have, we should have, we didn't. And so they got a glass of whiskey, and they said, well, it'll keep the generator going another half hour. And he said, why waste that good whiskey? I never will forget that scene. But I'm also one of those people who I look for solutions, and where the solutions I offer each day on the radio for everyone, I'm also looking and have already started a project for those who are interested in surviving the future, at least as long as it's going to be possible. And for that, I am, you know, grateful to have that awareness. We're all going to die. No one gets out of life alive, but knowing that you can live a better quality of life and with happiness and joy with the people you care about in your life and doing the things that are meaningful for you is the purpose of life, no matter how long you live. And so I also suggest that people spend quality time healing the past and having joy and happiness for every day and take none of it for granted, because in the near future, whether it's 2 years, 5 years, or 10 years, I believe that the very outside is going to be 10 years before you'll start to see mass catastrophic outcomes on our planet. And, of course, when people are starving or people can't survive and they become immigrants and you have a billion immigrants with no place to go and no one wanting them, then you're going to see the worst of human nature. But we will see, and hopefully we are all wrong. I wouldn't mind that at all. Thank you very much for being with us today, Guy McPherson. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. Again, this is the kind of program that's sobering, and it needs to be sobering. You know, when someone sits across me who've been diagnosed as terminally ill, they've gone to their cancer specialist, the oncologist has given them their chemotherapy, the radiologist, the radiation, and then it's come back, and now there's nothing more they can do, and they go into hospice care. That's when I start to work. And I'm applying that same attitude that the earth is not terminal. Our existence on it is. And I do not see any of the world leaders. I do not see the urgency within anyone. The urgency is the ball game on tonight or the Kardashians. Let's get involved in that circus the guy talked about. Boy, is that a misalignment of priorities. But for those who are looking to do something, I'll be doing several shows on what we can do. Thank you all for listening, and have a good day.
Hey, what's happening?
Brother, what's up?
This is a big party, man.
Yeah, brother,
I can dig it.
Stop right on.